Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting a massive sweep of arrest in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia says it has broken up planned Islamic State attacks in their kingdom, announcing it has arrested over 400 people in a series of raids. In a statement Saturday carried on the official state news agency, the Interior Ministry also accused those arrested over the past few weeks of conducting several attacks, including an Islamic State-claimed suicide bomb in May that killed 21 people in a village in the oil-rich eastern Qatif region. It was the deadliest militant assault in the kingdom in more than a decade. The Interior Ministry said that in June they thwarted a suicide bomb attack on a large mosque in eastern Saudi Arabia that can hold 3,000 worshippers, along with multiple planned attacks on other mosques and diplomatic and security bodies. The announcement comes a day after an attack by the Islamic State group on a crowded marketplace in Iraq's eastern Diyala province killed 115 people, including women and children, in one of the deadliest single attacks in the country over the past decade. The blast Friday is in a marketplace in the mainly Shiite town of Khan Bani Sa'ad, also wounded up to 170 people. Police officials said that while speaking anonymously because they weren't authorized to brief the media. Many people had gathered in the marketplace to celebrate the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan before the explosion. Islamic State militants claimed responsibility for the blast on social websites and said the target was Shiite Muslims. The group claimed on Twitter that the bomber was carrying about 3 tons of explosives in his vehicle. This is VOA News. Iran's top leader says an historic nuclear deal with world powers reached this week will not change Iran's policy toward what he termed the arrogant government of the United States. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said Saturday in a televised speech that U.S. policy in the Middle East runs counter to Tehran's strategy and that Iran will continue to support its allies in the Middle East, including the Lebanese Hezbollah, Palestinian resistance groups, and the Syrian government. Khamenei, who has the final say on all state matters, said Iran and the U.S. follow sharply different policies in the Middle East, making more a wide-ranging agreement unlikely. The U.S. president, meanwhile, continues to push for acceptance of the deal. Barack Obama says the agreement to get Iran to stop developing nuclear weapons does more than anyone has done before to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
Without this deal, there would be no limits on Iran's nuclear program. There would be no monitoring, no inspections. The sanctions we rallied the world to impose would unravel. Iran could move closer to a nuclear weapon. Other countries in the region might race to do the same, and we'd risk another war in the most volatile region in the world.
In his weekly Saturday address, Mr. Obama said Iran cannot cheat on the deal because the verification process it sets up is comprehensive and intrusive. He said if Iran reneges on the agreement, which calls for Iran to ship 98% of its nuclear material out of the country, the economic sanctions that have crippled the Iranian economy would snap back into place. In Kenya, the Westgate Shopping Mall in the capital of Nairobi has reopened nearly 2 years after it became the scene of one of the country's worst terror attacks, and just days before President Obama visits the country. The upscale mall opened Saturday with new security measures in place, including X-ray machines, explosive detectors, and guard towers. Reports indicate only a small number of mall employees who were present for the attacks are returning to the mall to work. While business owners have expressed confidence that the mall will once again become a bustling marketplace, some residents of the upper middle class neighborhoods nearby have expressed doubts that the new security measures will be enough to keep shoppers safe. A stampede at a religious festival attended by tens of thousands of people in eastern India left 2 women dead Saturday, according to police, the second deadly stampede at an Indian Hindu festival in less than a week. At least 10 others were injured in the melee at the Rath Yatra, or chariot festival, in the temple town of Puri in Orissa State, that according to Press Trust of India. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The head of the NRM Electoral Commission, which is the ruling party, Professor Tango Odoi, let him know that the rules require for him to make a payment first before he can have access to those forms.
A former Ugandan prime minister says it is illegal for the ruling party to demand presidential aspirants pay $6,000 before receiving nomination papers.
Build on the progress that's been made around issues of health and education. Focus on counterterrorism issues that are important in East Africa because of Al-Shabaab. And some of the tragedies that have happened inside of Kenya.
President Barack Obama heads to East Africa next week with counterterrorism high on the agenda.
We got an amazing response from the public. I think essentially people do want to help out, especially where the disparity in South Africa is so big between the wealthy and the poor. You know, everyone wants to do their bit.
And today the world joins South Africa to celebrate Nelson Mandela's birthday, recognized globally as Mandela Day. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Westgate Shopping Mall, which was attacked last year by Al-Shabaab militants, reopened in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Today, the attack by the Somali-based Islamist militant group left 67 people dead and scores injured in a siege that lasted 4 days. The reopening of the mall comes a week ahead of President Barack Obama's visit. The Nairobi City County Governor says the mall's reopening signals to the world that the capital is safe. For more, Franklin Wambugu, news editor at K24, a major television station in Nairobi, joins us live via telephone link up. Good evening, Franklin.
Good evening.
Well, Franklin, let me ask you, how has been the mood or what has been the feeling among Kenyans following the reopening of the Westgate Shopping Mall today?
I think it's a case of mixed feelings, really. On one hand, obviously, people are excited that nearly 2 years after that deadly attack that killed about 67 people at the Westgate Mall, the mall has reopened again. And obviously, there were so many people that suffered losses, both in terms of business and, of course, loss of life. So it's a feeling of things getting back to normal. But on the other hand, is a feeling that obviously that's a building that's still haunted based on what happened nearly 2 years ago. So there's some a bit of apprehension, you know, in as far as maybe customers or basically residents of Nairobi going back to the mall because of the events of that attack nearly 2 years ago. So it's a case of mixed feelings. There are people who are saying, you know, because of what happened, I may not go back there again. You know, because of the experience, either what they saw on television. And obviously, there were survivors following that attack. And obviously, there are thousands of people who are haunted by what exactly happened. But there's a general feeling that, yes, Kenya is back, Westgate is back, it's risen from the ashes.
Now, Franklin, based on what you just said, did some people express concern that since the government is still battling Al-Shabaab and Al-Shabaab has been attacking parts of the country, especially close to the Somali border, there could be future attacks at the Westgate Mall again?
Well, in fact, the concern for most people is not really with Westgate because, you know, the management has put in place measures, security measures, for example, hiring Israelis who will be in charge of securing, you know, that famous mall, both in terms of installations and making sure there are bomb detectors and things like that, just to make sure people are secure. But I think the concern for most people is the security with regard to other malls. Obviously, Nairobi, you know, is a fast developing you know, city and county as far as Kenya is concerned. There's growth in terms of infrastructure and in terms of malls coming up because of the thriving middle class. So the concern for most people is, yes, you may have secured Westgate better than it was, But there's a general feeling that security needs to be upped in other malls. So there's that general concern. But as far as Westgate is concerned, I think yes, there's a bit of apprehension. The people are glad that business has reopened and it's risen from the ashes, and business can continue as normal as it was. And there's that. The government has been very persistent in asking Kenyans to not give the opportunity to terrorists to interfere with the day-to-day livelihoods of Kenyans, the way people are used to going about their activities. So a bit of apprehension with regard to the security of malls around Nairobi and around the country. But I guess majority are glad that Westgate is back.
Now, are there any assurances from the security agencies, or for that matter, the government, about improving security or changing the security arrangement in other malls to make people feel safe following the reopening of this Westgate Mall?
Well, there was the response today by the Inspector General of Police saying that we have, as Kenyans, we have learned from our mistakes, from what happened nearly 2 years ago at Westgate. But with regard to the improvement of security in other malls, I think there's a lot that still needs to be done, although respective malls and supermarkets have put in place their own measures to improve security in and around the malls with regard to making sure that cars are detected, that people are searched and things like that, before they actually, access some of these malls. But the feeling is that there's a lot more that needs to be done with regard to cooperation between the national government, the county government, and the respective malls and the management of some of these big supermarket chains.
Now, Franklin, briefly, in 30 seconds, tell me whether the assurances made by the Inspector General of Police was welcomed by Kenyans, especially living in the capital, Nairobi.
Yes, I think it was welcome, but Kenyans are always apprehensive because we've had all these assurances time and time again, saying that, especially after an attack by Al-Shabaab, we've had these assurances that, we can never be defeated by these terrorists, we can never allow our lives to be distracted by the plans of a few errant individuals or groups of people. I think that assurance is always met with a bit of pessimism, obviously because of the attacks that we witnessed in the recent past, Westgate being a good example. There have been other attacks outside of Nairobi mostly. We haven't had an attack in Nairobi in the recent past, but I think most of these attacks have been in the far-flung areas of Kenya, the northeastern part of Kenya, of course, that borders Somalia, has become a soft target for some of these groups, specifically Al-Shabaab.
Thank you very much. Franklin Wambugu is a news editor at K24, a major Kenyan television station. He joined us live from the capital, Nairobi. Meanwhile, as the State Department renews its warning of possible terrorist attacks in Kenya, President Barack Obama heads to East Africa next week with counterterrorism high on the agenda. VOA correspondent R. Pandu has more from the White House.
During his 2013 visit to Senegal, South Africa, and Tanzania, President Obama announced initiatives boosting U.S. cooperation in trade, investment, and infrastructure on the continent. Mr. Obama says his trip to Kenya and Ethiopia is aimed at sending a similar message that the United States is a strong partner, not just for the two nations, but also for sub-Saharan Africa.
Build on the progress that's been made around issues of health and education, focus on counterterrorism issues that are important in East Africa because of Al-Shabaab and some of the tragedies that have happened inside of Kenya.
The U.S. president's first visit to his ancestral homeland comes amid continued deadly attacks in Kenya by al-Shabaab, and just days after the reopening of Nairobi's Westgate Mall, where militants gunned down 67 people in a 2013 siege. Counterterrorism factors into Mr. Obama's visit to African Union headquarters in neighboring Ethiopia, the first visit to the East African country by a sitting U.S. president. Jeffrey Smith with Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights says the U.S. sees Ethiopia as a key ally in the region, particularly in the fight against al-Shabaab.
And Ethiopia is really seen as a bulwark against that, not only in terms of regional cooperation, but contributing troops to AU peacekeeping missions as well across the continent. So in that regard, and particularly their role in the Sudan crisis, the South Sudan crisis, their role sort of being seen as a regional mediator.
But Smith says President Obama's visit sends the wrong message, citing Ethiopia's repressive regime.
What many people don't know is Ethiopia is the fourth most censored country in the world. They're the second largest jailer of journalists on the entire continent, second only to Eritrea, their next-door neighbor.
Atlantic Council's Bronwyn Bruton, who has met with Muslim democratic activists in Ethiopia, some who were recently found guilty of terrorism, also calls President Obama's trip a mistake.
The fact that Ethiopia is getting a visit from President Obama in the wake of that guilty verdict and in the wake of sweeping the elections, taking 100% of the seats, sends a disastrous message to the Ethiopian government.
A senior Obama administration official tells VOA the United States regularly communicates its human rights concerns with the Ethiopian government, both in public and in private. The official says, quote, "We engage so that we can urge and shape behavior in these areas." Aru Pandey, VOA News at the White House.
Patrick Amama Mbabazi, a former Ugandan prime minister, says it is illegal for the ruling party to demand that presidential hopefuls pay 20 million shillings, that is equivalent of $6,000, to obtain the papers needed to enter the race for the party's nomination. Mbabazi says the demand from the NRM's Internal Election Commission contradicts both the party's and the country's constitutions. For more, I reached Josephine Mayanja Nkanji, spokesperson for the former prime minister. She denied local media reports that Mr. Mbabazi refused to take the NRM nomination papers.
He did not refuse to take the paperwork. It was not given to him. He's actually denied the paperwork. The head of the NRM Electoral Commission, which is the ruling party, Professor Tango Odoi, let him know that the rules require for him to make a payment first before he can have access to those forms. He also told him that in any event, the forms had been reverted to the Central Executive Committee, SEC, of the NRM to be discussed today. So he was unable to get a copy of the forms.
He said the demand for him to pay 20 million shillings before the forms are given to him is illegal. Is this the case?
It is. So under the law, actually, because what he was looking at was the Presidential Elections Act as well as the Constitution itself, and it does show that in this case there is nothing like that. There is no, according to him, there is no law that requires for somebody, an aspirant, to pay an amount of fees to get the nomination forms or to get the instructions.
Does that mean that he is ready to legally challenge this, since he, being an attorney himself, has that option?
That is something that, you know, he will do if he has to. But at the moment, the lawyers, as well as his lawyers, have gone ahead to draft his complaint and what he's standing on to make those complaints to the Central Executive Committee to ask them to review the regulations, because as it happens, he actually had a copy of the regulations, of the nomination forms. He had a copy anyway. So they've written and are hoping for redress. So at that point, until we hear from them, we really can't say what's going to happen.
His critics are saying that he appears to be playing a political game, knowing very well that he doesn't stand a chance of challenging the enormous support that incumbent President Museveni enjoys within the rank and file of the ruling party. So he's just playing a game to the gallery as they speak. What is your take on that?
I don't think so. I don't think anybody purchases anything, even in a store. You have to see the item that you are purchasing. So his request to have a copy of the form so he can understand the regulations was not out of order. It's not a game. It is a normal request by any person.
But
he's not refusing to pay. He's more than happy to pay. All he's asking for is to know what are the rules of the game before he begins to play it.
But he was a former Secretary General of the party, so one will wish to say that since he knows the ins and outs of the workings of the ruling party, he should not even claim that he doesn't know the rules governing it.
Excuse me, these are new rules. These rules did not exist until, a week ago? These are new rules. They were not in the party at all. Never have been. In fact, even as we speak, they are not in the party constitution. The way that Professor Tango Doi, who is the head of the Electoral Commission, again, of the NRM, explained it, he says, you see, in the NRM party constitution, not much is said. Not many rules are set for the Electoral Commission. So what they have done is to create these new rules or extra rules to govern the process, which is fine. The only issue is that the rules that they have set are not correct both in law and in the spirit of the law.
So does that mean that he thinks that he's somewhat being deprived or being prevented from legally challenging or following the due process to contest as a presidential aspirant within the NRM? Is that a suspicion?
That's correct. But again, that is again dependent on what Central Executive Committee decides to do. So it's premature at this point, you know, for him to come to that conclusion. Seeing what the rules are in these forms would lead you to that conclusion. However, again, he's seeking redress. He's asking the other members, you know, of the party, most especially SEC, to reconsider and look at it. He's gone section by section in his letter to them to ask them to point out the different areas where there is contention, you know, which clash either with the Constitution or with the Presidential Elections Act. He's done that. So it's due diligence. And really now the ball is in their court to decide whether he's right or he's wrong and what they would like to do about it.
Josephine Mayanja Nkanji is the spokesperson for the former Ugandan Prime Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. A novel compound has been developed to treat an old foe, malaria, a disease that infects more than 200 million people per year and kills 500,000 of them. The drug cripples a critical protein that is essential for the malaria parasite's survival. Viewer's Jessica Berman reports.
The compound, called DSM-265, is the first of a new class of drugs to treat malaria. Researchers say it could be one of the first single-dose cures against one of the deadliest diseases in the world. DSM-265 targets a protein that the malaria parasite needs in order to reproduce. Without the protein, the parasite cannot continue to infect its host. The compound destroys the parasite in all of its difficult-to-treat stages, from microscopic spores that enter the body through a mosquito bite to the liver stage, where larvae are nurtured, eventually infecting circulating red blood cells by the millions. Pradeep Rathod is a chemistry professor at the University of Washington, part of a large international team involving researchers from 20 institutions that discovered DSM-265. He says studies initially showed the compound was very effective against parasites that had invaded red blood cells. Other tests were equally promising.
And those studies showed that the compound is really very good against liver stage forms too. And so it can be used as a prophylactic. It can be used in the areas where people are anticipating getting bitten by mosquitoes and getting infected so that we pick out the parasite in its very early stages before it shows up in the blood.
It's been years since a new class of anti-malarial drugs has come along. Until now, the latest drugs were variations of old compounds discovered decades ago, and strains of malaria parasites resistant to them have been reported in Southeast Asia. DSM stands for Dallas, Seattle, Melbourne. The three cities that are home to the lead researchers who tested hundreds of molecules before hitting on the version, the 265th version of the new drug that is most effective at inhibiting the parasite. Rathod says the method used to discover DSM-265 could someday lead to even more effective drugs against malaria.
We're getting good at this and we can make more molecules. And, you know, some people think if you make really good antimalarial that are safe every 5 or 10 years, and as countries are developing economically, all of this together will get us to a point where we have to stop worrying about this disease. That's the big dream.
The anti-malaria drug DSM-265 was described in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Early clinical trials are underway now, and more are expected to begin soon. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Nearly 2 years after his death, Nelson Mandela has gone digital with an app that encourages users to support charitable organizations in need. The Play Your Part app has already garnered donations, and its creators say it's a new way to honor the beloved late South African president's legacy on Mandela Day, July 18. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
Nelson Mandela Day, declared by the UN in 2009, has evolved into a day for South Africans to do charitable work for 67 minutes. The Nelson Mandela Foundation says that's 1 minute for every year Mr. Mandela gave to his struggle for equality. And now, on what would have been his 97th birthday, Mr. Mandela has gone digital with an app to help South Africans give back. The new Play Your Part app, developed by a company called Going the Extra Mile, or GEM, allows South African users to find charitable organizations in need of donations and volunteers and to contribute. Developer David Shields says his app has had a great reception.
We've had an amazing response from the public. I think essentially people do want to help out, especially where the disparity in South Africa is so big between the wealthy and the poor. You know, everyone wants to do their bit. They just didn't know how. So this gives them a platform to do so.
App users can earn GEM points by logging their volunteer activity, which they can trade for airtime, data, or electricity credit. Or they can double down on the charitable spirit and donate their points to needy organizations. Shield says the app may spread to other African nations like Mauritius, Kenya, and Nigeria. Users can find links to the app by searching for GEM projects on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Brand South Africa's general manager for marketing, Sitembile Ndobela, says the app fulfills Mr. Mandela's legacy and passions. Like many South Africans, she referred to him by his clan name, Madiba.
We want to promote a culture in the country where every South African gets an opportunity to live Madiba's legacy. And really, if one were to unpack what is Madiba's legacy, a man who stood for education, a man who loved children, a man who served for others and selflessly gave his life so that we can all be free.
Mr. Mandela went to prison for 27 years for his opposition to the racist apartheid regime. He emerged in 1990 and was elected South Africa's first black president in the nation's first democratic all-race elections in 1994. He died in 2013 at the age of 95. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Barack Obama prepares to travel to Kenya, his father's homeland, for the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, and to Ethiopia to meet with African Union officials. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of his trip to the continent. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing bribery, an issue of concern all over the world. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC. Right here on VOA Africa. Thank you.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Right now, it's time for music from African collection. Enjoy. Kakina soleda, fish naga feda, the love we get naga weda. Oh na 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 na. Nega don't know you. This is a song for all the lovers out there. Naga, baby, picture me and you. What I know the past, oh, I can't live a moment without you. Now one day I do. The journey is not easy, but I know it's impossible. If only you could plan, oh, only you. Oh yeah. Take bullets for you, me, I know they play you.
Give you what? Sell you what?
Talk to the news and all over the
radio.
Tell only Wally, yo. Say me too,
you.
A beautiful girl like you need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, a beautiful girl like you need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, because you know, Toledo fish no get better. The love way I get no get weather, no get weather. So, you know, Toledo fish no get better. The love way I get no get weather, no get weather. Yeah. Baby girl, you my one and only. Yeah. And anything that you want, just follow with me, no way. Say I'm your man, your salon, but no, yeah. Say mama, don't beat me, pray for you sake, I'm ready for dying. Take bullets for you, me, I know they play you.
Tell you what, tell you what.
Talk to the news and all about it,
tell you what, tell you what.
Tell only one, yo.
Tell you what,
say me too, yo. A beautiful girl like you, big man like me. I'm always gonna make you to feel alright. Like me, a beautiful girl like you, big man like me. I'm always gonna make you to feel alright. Like me, because you know the leather, fish no get better. The love way I get no get weather, no get weather. So, you know the leather, fish no get better. The love way I get no get better, no better. Baby, you know me, I'm your man, I can be a better man. Baby, you know me, oh. Baby, you know me, your man, I can be a better man. Baby, you know me, no. Hey, if you told me, I'd understand, but take my life away, cause you the one, my only hope. Baby, you the one in all. Nothing can separate me from you, no. Oh, baby, yeah. Oh, I'm a beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, a beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, because you know the leather, fish no get better. The love way I get no get weather, no get weather. So you know the leather, fish no get better. The love way I get no get weather, no get weather.
This is a love song for everybody all over the world. Be black or white. some loving. The way you're moving your body from left and right, you own somebody. Now they bump, look at them and them look at you. Everybody just feeling you, just feeling you. Mama, 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 go like to the balaga. Chop in the banana, oh, come and chop in the banana.
I'm not the one. Baby, they make me feel in it. She, they make me feel alright. When I look into your eyes, I go walk you down the aisle. I didn't tell you, say, now you. Hey. Go be my persona, baby.
And that was music from the continent. Hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. I also pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This week, a very important issue regarding Iran and the role of the United States in the new agreement between the international community and the state of Iran. There are a number of issues to be addressed with regard to U.S. policy towards Iran or U.S. decision with regard to the historical relationship between the state of Iran since the Iranian Revolution and to the present moment. There are over 40 years since the days of Imam Khomeini and where we are now. Much has been written about this phenomenon. And of course, American-Iranian relations have consequences for the continent of Africa. Much has been written about Iranian-African relations since the Iranian Revolution. And today, when we have this new agreement, in light of the impending visit of the president to Kenya, you have some very interesting historical dots to be connected. Number one, there is a relationship between the United States and Iran since the rise of the United States as a dominant power during the Cold War. And of course, the Shah of Iran is much talked about as a figure in Iranian history whose activities link Iranian history with South Africa, where he was in exile when the regime he belonged to was overthrown by Mossadegh, the revolutionary Iranian. And this is how you talk about Iran and Africa by way of South Africa during the Cold War and how the Shah was restored to power by the United States and Britain and other allies in the West. And of course, that was the beginning of the Shah of Iran, and that led to the revolution in Iran. Today, when we come to look at America's relations with Iran, we look at the African background, because Africa is not a very important player in that narrative. It is the Arab states, Saudi Arabia, and the other Gulf countries. The story of the Shah is very much related in this particular moment to the history of American-Iranian relations. The second figure that is very important, not only between the Shah of Iran and the United States, the Shah of Iran and Africa. As a footnote here, when the Shah of Iran was alive and he was in power, he had a meeting with an African leader called Leopold Sedat Senghor. Senghor went to Iran, and in his typical way, wherever he went, he gave lectures linking black identity, negritude, and the civilization he was visiting. When he came to the United States here, Leopold Senghor talked about Americanité and negritude. When he went to Iran, he talked about Iranitude and negritude. He went to India, he talked about Indian identity and negritude. So that footnote is very relevant in talking about now, because when you connect with that, you can see how culture, politics, united Iran, America, and Africa. When you now go into Imam Khomeini, we change the narrative in terms of America's relations with Iran. It is now religiously grounded, theologically grounded. And this is where the second dot becomes very important. Because when Khomeini came to power, it was a shock for even American leaders at that time. It was difficult for the Jimmy Carter administration and the thinkers around Jimmy Carter, well, they are politicians or scholars, trying to understand Khomeini. The former UN representative, Andrew Young, former mayor, was at the UN at that time. And when he looked at Khomeini, he made a statement which has been looked at by political rivals differently. He saw him as a saint at that time. There was the naivete about things. In the end, unfortunately, Jimmy Carter was voted out. Reagan came to power. And then Iranian-American relations broke down totally. And now we are at the third stage, where you now have political relationship between the Iranians and the United States, Iranian and Africa. The relationship between Iran and Africa took a new turn. Religion, Islam. And this is how you move to the third dot. Terrorism becomes very much linked to the politics. The Iranians were no longer involved in dealing with the Middle East. The Iranians under the Shah supporting Palestinians. No, that was not an issue. When Khomeini came, the Palestinian issue became very important. It was elevated to a theological issue, different from the Shah of Iran. And that affected Iranian-American relations. You now move to the third level, where you now move from the realm of politics and culture, as Senghor was trying to do for Africa. Africans now are being lobbied by the Iranians through Islamic mobilization. And that's how the Shah of Iran was overthrown. He was definitely linked with the Arabs and the Muslims when they established the Organization of Islamic Conference, because the Shah of Iran, King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and Gaddafi were among movers of that narrative. But now what we have, we move from politics and culture, diplomacy at one level, America and Iran, America and Africa, Iran and Africa. You move to a second stage. Now you move to where you bring theology and religion. And then you move on to violence, political violence, terrorism. These three narratives are coming together now. And this is how, when you move from diplomacy, politics, international relations, you now move into theological development in politics. When radicalism and religion begin to come together, you go back to the days of the Crusades, where religion and politics are confined together. You now move to terrorism. And this is where terrorism becomes very important in American foreign policy, Iranian foreign policy, African foreign policy. So the African leaders, the Iranians, and the Americans are now facing this problem of nuclear weapons. And that's where we are now in. So when you look at U.S. policy towards Africa, U.S. policy towards Iran and the Middle East, terrorism, religion become two bones of contention. I will conclude by saying President Obama has tried his very best. He is dealing with a very difficult crisis. I think all his successors, they will have to deal with this difficult knot. If they don't accept it now, we are waiting for more serious crises ahead, because we have to put the Iranian feet to the fire. This is my position, and that's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Cornelius Tino. We say a big thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a clear conscience is usually the sign of a bad memory. That is to say, when you speak the truth, you don't need a good memory. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist six rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yaw Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jok Riak, and Major General Santino Deng Wal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All six had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.